This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Here is what's coming up on African News Tonight.
This is the usual cat and mouse game between government and retailers going on. Now retailers are being forced, for example, to accept.
That's Betty Piri, a business graduate and informal trader on Zimbabwe's latest effort to stabilize its weakening currency. Details coming up also. In Cameroon, the closure of most restaurants and border trade during the COVID pandemic has dropped food prices by up to 70%. And Tanzania's move to reopen the country's tourism has been welcomed by many in the industry. We'll have all these and more ahead on African News Tonight. But first, our top story. After his recent meeting in Paris with French President Macron, Tunisian President Kais Saied said foreign powers are trying to control Tunisia's future, relying on conspirators inside the country to plot a coup. He declined to name names. He also joined some Tunisian politicians in criticizing the parliament speaker for his contacts with the UN-backed government in Libya. VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shanawi discussed these developments with William Lawrence, professor of political science at the American University in Washington.
Well, there have been plots in neighboring Libya, but it's not clear yet whether there are active plots in Tunisia. The same Gulf country plus Turkey and Egypt proxy battling in Syria, in Yemen, in Libya, and a number of other theaters has spread to Tunisia as well. Although most of the proxies that operate in Tunisia are more economic than politically oriented, but there's no question that the desire of Gulf countries in particular to develop clients or proxies in Tunisia to carry their political water is going on. There's funding of political parties and politicians at times in the past, although I haven't seen any evidence of it going on right now. And certainly there's talk of plots constantly, every day in Tunisia, but it's unclear, you know, how much of this is just the Sturm und Drang, you know, of Tunisian politics and the accusations that go on all the time and how much is grounded in reality. Certainly, Kais Saied himself, the president, is subject to a lot of pressures from all sides, and that's affecting the accusations that are going on now. Certainly, as well, his recent meeting with Macron, it was clear that he could have sort of come down on one side or the other on a variety of subjects on which he's getting pressure, and he was very, very neutral in his comments, including towards issues that Macron cares about. So a lot of this is just Kais Saied trying to protect his own political position in Tunisia and make accusations about these pressures in order to push back on them a little bit.
In recent months, Ennahda Islamist Party has been under attack inside the parliament, and President Saied joined the critics, saying that Speaker of the Parliament, Rashid Ghannouchi, made a mistake by contacting the head of the Government of National Accord in Libya. Does that mean the end of political consensus that made the transition smooth in Tunisia?
No, but that consensus is under a lot of pressure and in flux. The consensus was relatively strong in 2011 and 2012, and then came under a crisis in 2013, in the crisis that led to the Nobel Peace Prize, which led to the new consensus, which was reinvigorated and then formalized into something called the Carthage Pact, which lasted until 2018. And since 2018, Tunisian politics has been fraught with greater conflict between the parties, and an attempt by Ennahda, the largest party, to get back to that consensual politics, which makes the government more able to get things done. But so far, it's been unable to form a national unity government. And right now, Tunisian politics are driven by blocs. And the criticism of Ghannouchi, which Saied joined, is part of an attempt to rein in Ennahda. And it's also in defense of the constitutional and systemic arrangement in which the president has the lead on foreign policy and defense policy, and the prime minister has the lead on economic and domestic policy. And it's also an attempt to weaken any pro-Islamist alliance between Tunisia and Libya, which many of the parties are against. But the fact that a number of parties which are in government voted against Ghannouchi in the latest vote indicates that we are further away from a national consensus alliance right now, and we're going to continue to have rocky road going forward in Tunisian politics.
That was William Lawrence, professor of political science at the American University in Washington, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shanawi. Following the introduction of Zimbabwe's foreign currency auction system, the domestic currency's value collapsed. And that has meant the prices of basic commodities such as fuel and cooking oil have soared, making it even harder for people to make ends meet. Arigando gives us the situation in Bulawayo, the country's second largest city.
Zimbabwe's economy has struggled for years, and the lockdown this year because of the coronavirus pandemic has deepened crisis and further weakened the Zimbabwe RTGS dollar. To stem the collapse of the currency, the Reserve Bank of Zimbabwe instituted a new auction system for trading foreign exchange and cracked down on the unofficial parallel currency market. But the first auction on June 23rd, however, sent the currency tumbling to 57 to the US dollar from the previous peg of 25. In the unofficial parallel market, the RTGS had been as low as 100 to the US dollar. Many Zimbabweans say the new system is worsening the situation. Betty Piri is a 35-year-old business graduate and informal trader.
This is the usual cat and mouse game between government and retailers going on. Now retailers are being forced, for example, to accept a Zim dollar rate for their goods, which they know if they sell the goods at that rate, they'll never be able to reorder.
Piri says the official auction rate, 57 RTGS dollars, means retailers have no choice but to hike foreign currency prices to make up the shortfall and be able to replace goods.
Case in point, a bottle of cooking oil. We've all known that for the longest time, a bottle of cooking oil has been going for $3. But if a retailer is asked to use a rate of 1:50 when accepting RTGS dollars for that bottle of cooking oil, it means that the retailer has to take back, has to sell the bottle of cooking oil at $150, which is a loss. The retailer knows that the true value of my bottle of cooking oil in RTGS terms should be $300. And so instead of selling it $3, they're just going to have to say $300 divided by 50. So to me, all that's going to happen is that prices are going to go up in US dollar terms.
Zimbabwe's economy has long been battered by a combination of mismanagement, international sanctions, political uncertainty, and drought. There are shortages of currency, food, fuel, medicines, and other imported goods. The economics website, Trading Economics, shows Zimbabwe's annual inflation rate soared for a fourth consecutive month to 785.6% in May of 2020 from 765.6% in April. This month, the government gave civil servants a pay rise of US$75 a month, but most people do not get foreign currency salaries. Economic analysts say that in this environment, no one is immune to the price increases. Alice Dube is an informal trader.
The rates are really affecting me as a trader because I have to increase my prices. I have to increase my charges to my customers, of which then the business, it's so low. It gets slow because business is now very, very slow because people are no longer buying as they used to.
Dube says she will be forced to get goods for sale by smuggling from neighboring South Africa as it is no longer viable to order from local suppliers. Economic analyst Gift Mgano says the economic fundamentals in the country mean that the auction system is doomed to fail and that it in fact marks the death of the Zimbabwe dollar.
But what we need to be very clear when we are analyzing economics, to be very clear in terms of honesty, that if you put a market system which excludes other people, they'll find themselves excluded and they'll use the alternative. The Zim dollar as we speak right now, it is the graveyard. We're actually holding shovels and picks to bury it. And the shovels and the picks are the payment of salaries in US dollars and the price in which it's been allowed to happen in US dollars. We are already there, and I said in 2 months' time, I am convinced that we'll be talking about any Zim dollar is.
Already, some traders around the country's informal markets are refusing payment in the local currency. For the present time in the country's second largest city, the trend is not yet caught on. Reporting for VOA, this is Adigondo in Bulawayo.
As the world marks the International Day in support of victims of torture, Zimbabwe wonders when torture will ever end after a series of cases that have victimized civic society members and political activists. Reporter Kuzai Zenawashi has the details.
Tatenda Mombeyarara, a social justice activist, tells his story.
Last year in August, I was abducted and tortured by unknown persons, allegedly for my activism. Today, I retain physical and emotional wounds, which have affected my normal life.
Dzikama Ibere is the director of Zimbabwe Human Rights Association, or ZIMRights, a non-profit organization with a mandate to help torture victims. He speaks about Zimbabwe's long history of such abuses.
Torture has been with us since the pre-colonial era, where the use of torture was preferred on criminals, on prisoners of war. During the colonial period, it was used by the colonial government. The current government has inherited a very powerful infrastructure of torture, which is the culture of torturing suspects by the police. While torture has been widely condemned throughout the world, it has still continued to exist in Zimbabwe.
The government has repeatedly denied such allegations. Zimbabweans thought torture would end when President Emmerson Mnangagwa came into power through a military coup in 2017. But there have been multiple cases, some targeted against high-profile activists, union leaders, and opposition figures. Bere claims Zimbabwe ranks high on torture, which is sustained by the powerful development of an infrastructure of torture and ways of hiding it, or even blaming the victim for allegedly faking or staging incidents. Prosecution of kidnappings, beatings, and other abuses, allegedly by security forces, is virtually non-existent.
Geographically, Zimbabwe has always been the capital of torture. And in terms of the perpetrators, out of all the violations, the police have always been on top of the perpetrators of torture, with the police committing 72% of all the violations that happen in this country.
Bere says residents have often been tortured for divergent political views or during interrogation of suspected criminals. Bere says, since the state is the main actor, it is important that it commits to ending torture, including ratification of the Convention Against Torture, passage of laws that strongly discourage it, and creation of measures to rehabilitate victims. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zinabashi from Harare.
The Gambia's justice minister has resigned for the second time in 2 years, and this time he says he's moving on. At a news conference today, Abubakar Tambadou called on Gambians to jealously safeguard their country's peace and stability. He also vowed that exiled Gambian dictator Yahya Jammeh will one day have his day in court. Reporter Pandera Mbai reports from Raleigh, North Carolina.
Tambadou was the first justice minister appointed in Barrow's administration. He quit in 2018, then rescinded his resignation. Today, Tambadou thanked Barrow for giving him the opportunity to serve his country and said he is pursuing an appointment with the United Nations. Tambadou spoke on the numerous judicial reform projects initiated by his former ministry. This includes establishing the Jammeh Commission to investigate the corrupt practices of Jammeh's former government and creating the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, the Constitutional Review Commission, and others. Tambadou knows that, despite such achievements, Gambians should remember that establishing democracy isn't easy.
For without peace, there cannot be democracy or development or justice. Our challenge going forward is to make this peace sustainable and turn it into stability for our people. And yes, the choice is ours, each and every one of us. We can either choose to live in peace or not.
Tambadou says the biggest threat facing Gambia's fledgling democracy is misinformation. He urged the media to report responsibly and avoid being used as a pawn for spreading false news. He says the media has a critical role in shaping Gambia's democratic future. Tambedu also has a stern message for Jammeh's supporters who were not happy with his work as justice minister.
I am aware that my principled position on former President Jammeh has not endeared me to his supporters and sympathizers. And to them, I say, Jammeh belongs to the past. So wake up from your dreams of a Jammeh political comeback and move on with your lives.
Tambedu has assured the victims of Jammeh's rule that the former authoritarian leader will face justice one day.
He has caused too much pain and suffering to the people of this country throughout his 22-year reign of terror, as the TRRC keeps revealing. He has, during this period, destroyed the innocence and soul of Gambian society with the sheer brutality of his crimes. And for this, he will be brought to account someday here or abroad. He will surely have his day in court.
Tambedu has expressed confidence in his successor, Daouda Diallo, a former judicial official. For VOA Africa, this is Pandering by reporting from Raleigh, North Carolina.
George Floyd, a black man, died after a police officer held his knee on his neck for nearly 9 minutes. Protesters call for an end to police violence towards African Americans and equal treatment for all. The majority of Americans say they support those demands, and many cities and state governments have started to rethink how police do their jobs and to look at how racism and the legacy of slavery continue to play in the country. We talked with several immigrants from Africa about the Black Lives Matter movement in the U.S. and the protests in the country. Today, we bring you a few more of their comments. Namidi Obiezi Nawadalor from Nigeria is a nurse in the U.S. state of Texas. He says he cannot understand how police officers could have acted the way they did in Floyd's death, and notes that many of the abuses being protested are coming to light because of the prevalence of camera phones.
And sometimes I wonder, if we never had video phones, most of these things would never come to light. And sometimes I also wonder what had happened in the past before the application of video phones. The issues that led to the protests is just an unbelievable thing to have happened. How do you, as a police officer, having restrained someone whom you believe committed a crime, or in this case is George Floyd, is said to have used a fake or forged $20 bill at a grocery shop. He's already been restrained, and yet this police officer gleefully placed his knee on his neck that led to his death. That can never be allowed to happen.
He says, however, that he thinks most U.S. police officers try to do a good job, but that police unions are too powerful and are able to protect what he calls bad eggs who commit abuses. Yaoni Yarko lives in New York. The native of Ghana says the video showing George Floyd's death has led to some shift in social attitudes.
Yeah, it's shifted, but it's a shift which is part of a progression. So, you know, the past 3-4 years in the United States have been fairly ugly here. You know, this is not obviously the first case. There are just many situations where you just feel like, don't you guys care? Don't you see that people are hurting? Don't you see that the system is rigged? So things have changed, but what we saw on the video is a more shocking version of things which we sort of knew was there. You sort of try not to think too much about it, but now it's right in your face.
Abike Ajuan, who lives in the state of Maryland near Washington, D.C., says, changing laws and rules for police won't solve the problem because racism is in large part a spiritual problem. The Nigerian American says you cannot legislate a man's heart, and that real change will take compassion, reconciliation, and understanding. But she sees hope for change.
As for my concerns going forward, my prayer and my concerns are that the generation that is on ground now would really look to the past and look at the work that has been done and not take it for granted and just continue to carry it on. I'm hopeful of this generation because I do see a lot of young people, even little kids, they're out protesting. They have a level of understanding, even at their young age, of what is going on. My prayer is that people would not become cynical. Again, I believe this is a twofold issue. Yes, it is a social issue, but I do believe it has spiritual roots in it as well.
That was Abike Ajuwon, a systems analyst and housewife in the U.S. state of Maryland, sharing her thoughts on protests sparked by the death of George Floyd in May. Tanzania's move to reopen the country to tourism has been welcomed by many in the industry. But some tour operators worry that the government's lack of candor on the extent of COVID-19 infections will keep foreign tourists away. President John Magufuli recently declared the country free of COVID-19, a statement that has already been proven wrong. Charles Kombe reports from Morogoro, Tanzania.
Tanzania's Mikumi National Park last year attracted around 50,000 tourists, about 40% of them foreigners. The coronavirus pandemic brought foreign tourism to a halt in March when international flights and parks were closed. The park is seeing visitors slowly return after the government in May allowed flights and tourism to resume, but they are mainly locals. Yasir El Haq is a Tanzanian tourist.
We came to Mikumi to come and refresh from the quarantine that we were before from the coronavirus, just to have a bit of fresh air. So we came here for the weekend, me and my fellow riders, as you can see.
President John Magufuli in May declared Tanzania had defeated the virus, a claim that health experts and its neighbors dismiss. Dozens of Tanzanian truckers have since tested positive for COVID-19 at Kenya's border, while Tanzania has refused to release coronavirus infection figures since April. Nonetheless, Tanzanian authorities say this is the right time to open up for tourists. Minister of Natural Resources and Tourism Hamis Kigwangala says his ministry is observing all preventive measures.
In Tanzania, to the contrary, the number of cases and hospitalizations, deaths, has completely gone down over the past few weeks. And it's the right timing as well because we put in place all the necessary measures for prevention and control of the spread of COVID-19 in the country.
But not everyone in Tanzania's tourism industry is following the herd. Some say the government's lack of honesty with the coronavirus infection numbers could keep visitors away. Raymond Kisasembe is the managing director of Patriot Tours and Safaris Limited.
Wasiwasi upo kwa sababu wa wateja tunawategemea.
Kisasembe says there are worries because customers that they depend on are those from outside the country. He adds that, as it is known, domestic tourism does not go that far to benefit those who are working in the tourism sector. Tanzania's tourism industry accounts about 70% of the country's gross domestic product, while opening to tourists could bolster the economy. How Tanzania handles the pandemic could have a much longer term effect. Charles Kombe for VOA News, Morogoro, Tanzania.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, thank you for tuning in and choosing The Voice of America.
VOA Africa has built a successful, effective social media strategy through Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and other digital platforms. We are responding to our audience on the African continent and in the global diaspora. We believe in the power of connection and interaction to bring you news that is comprehensive, accurate, and objective. We see the changes in technology as an opportunity to engage with our audiences about the issues that affect them. At VOA Africa, we don't just report the news, we help shape the conversation on the continent. VOA, your trusted source for news and information.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning in to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.